Welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of the Practical 365 Podcast. With me, Steve Goodman, and fellow chief editor, Paul Robichaud. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve. Pancake the Cat and I are here on duty, ready to talk about a pretty interesting list of things today. Our listeners are going to hear the cat in the background, I'm afraid.
There's nothing too bad about hearing a cat purring away as we talk.
Well, it's his nap time, and I didn't want to disturb him.
It's better than me bringing the dog in here and it constantly barking in the background, because that's annoying, but I can deal with purring, as I hope you at home can as well. So the big, I guess, news isn't the word, because we knew this was coming. Exchange 2010 is dead. It is no longer around. It left support this week.
It did. And I'm not exaggerating when I say it's a sad day. You know, that
it does feel more. I'm not going to feel this way about Exchange 2013.
You know, I don't think many people felt this way about Exchange 2003. If I'm honest, or Exchange 2007. I think 2010. You know, there was sort of this informal agreement among a lot of people in the community that Microsoft really got every other version of Exchange was right. You know what I mean? That they would introduce a feature and maybe it wasn't quite fully baked. I think of active-active clustering, for example. And then the next release, that's when they got it right. So if you look at all the things that were released in 2007, and you look at how those features evolved into 2010 and how performant and stable and robust 2010 was compared to 2007, I don't think I want to say the high water mark of Exchange product engineering, but certainly one of the peaks in terms of the product quality and robustness and customer satisfaction.
Well, that's it. I think if it hadn't went out of support, it wasn't going to go out of support. There's people that would happily continue running it for a few years longer. But I've heard it called the Windows 7 of Exchange versions, with Exchange 2007 being the Vista of that.
Ooh. Wow.
Which, ouch. Vista, and if you look back at Vista and you think about the things that it introduced that then came into Windows 7, or if you look at what Windows 2008 and 2008 R2, right? They weren't fundamentally massively different in the things that they brought. It's just one was a lot better baked and more refined, and all of the niggly things that they perhaps hadn't got right were sorted in Windows 7. And I think the same applied to Exchange 2010, because there were some things, like, do you remember LCR in 2007?
I do indeed.
Like, not many people really use that in production, as far as I'm aware. And then we still had single copy clusters, which I never implemented, but people probably did, especially if they were running heavily in a SAN-based environment. SCR, where you could have that third copy in 2007, and then you'd to your CCR cluster, and things like that never really took off in 2007. They just weren't quite right. But with 2010, we got the database taken away from a storage group as an object in the organization that could be attached to servers in the DAG. And what was it, block level replication? All the things like that that really made the things that were good about 2007 but weren't quite perfect were still fundamental concepts that they got right in 2010 today. Really, you know, they're the underpinnings of how Exchange Online works.
Right. And 2010 was really the first version that Microsoft tried to scale aggressively. So there used to be a separate, I don't know that you'd call it a product exactly, because you couldn't buy it. But if you were a large telecom or a large hosting provider, there was a hosted Exchange variant.
Oh, yes.
There was a bunch of scripts and custom utilities. It was sort of like a mega super resource kit that you could get from Microsoft if you were going to offer hosted Exchange email to your customers at very large scale. And 2010 was really the first version of Exchange that could support that.
No. And that was the hosting flag when you went to install it. And that was probably the bit that they didn't get quite perfect, because we had to wait a few years for address book policies to try and give that GAL segmentation. I seem to remember that taking quite a long time for them to get that bit right, for people to upgrade from 2007 hosted environments with GAL segmentation to 2010. But it was built for the cloud. When they built 2010, it was around about the same time that they were building out Live at Edu, what had Exchange Online as a part of it,
right,
in its beta. And that was being built at the same time as the released version of Exchange 2010. It started off cloud native and sort of grew from there. And it's hard to not look back on Exchange 2010 as having a pretty good run.
I think it has. You know, I mean, for any software product to still be in broad or even narrow customer use 11 or 12 years after its introduction, that's a pretty significant milestone, right? If you look at how often that happens, it's really relegated to consumer operating systems, line of business application platforms for things like Oracle and SAP and whatnot, and a really select number of platform applications, Exchange 2010 being one of them. You know, many versions of Exchange, many other utilities. I mean, I don't think there are a lot of people still running SharePoint 2010 out there.
There's one more than you think. But yeah, I think they tailed off sooner than Exchange 2010. But Link 2010 is the one that pops to my mind, where people were quite motivated to upgrade to Link 2013 from that version. So are you still seeing any 2010 in the wild?
I haven't seen any in some time, but remember, the bulk of the customers that I work with now are people who have moved to the cloud and need cloud management help, or they're moving their archive systems. And there, I'm a little ashamed to admit, I've got customers that are still using Exchange 2007 to run their archives, because that's what third-party archiving system is built on top of.
Okay, well, that sounds worse.
Oh, it's terrible. I don't endorse it.
No. Because I spoke to Greg Taylor earlier in the year, and he seemed pretty adamant that they weren't going to be providing any special extensions for Exchange 2010. That was right when stuff hit earlier in the year. They extended some things around legacy authentication, but they were pretty adamant that even those big customers that stood out with the Exchange 2007 end of support, they weren't going to extend it for that. They weren't going to provide patches. But I've still got at least one customer, and I've been encouraging them to finally decommission. They moved their last mailbox before Christmas, and then they moved the public folders, January or February, and then of course a lot of stuff went on hold for them. And they were pretty well ahead, and it's only recently, over the last few weeks, that some of the prerequisites that they were supposed to be doing, they've been able to get back up and do. But unfortunately, they've missed that deadline. Obviously, it's just a server managing hybrid and mail relay to remove. But I think the last hands-on I had was 4 or 5 weeks ago, decommissioning a reasonably large Exchange 2010 environment for an insurer, as they'd already got 2016 hybrid in, and it was just getting rid of the last public folders there, getting everything swung over, getting those sort of hard to move applications across that where the vendor needed to support it, the specific config settings that needed to be changed, and nobody knew what they were, and got to the point where I was involved where they just needed to do it. And even though all that org knowledge had gone, it was just, well, let's just dive in and get on a call with the vendor if we need to. Let's go through all these different applications that are struggling to pick up mail from a newer version of Exchange and so on, and get this bottomed out. And that was done successfully. But prior to that, it was something that had been holding them back for some time. And I bet there's quite a few organisations in some of those camps where they've struggled to get rid of the last parts of Exchange, and they've struggled to actually find the time to do it as well, with so many other things being around.
It's always hard to prioritize decommissioning things unless they are actively hazardous in some way. Like if your server shoots fireballs at people, you're probably going to decommission it sooner than you would if it just sort of sits over in the corner minding its own business. But that technical debt always piles up in the end.
Right. Well, don't forget, earlier we had a security flaw in Exchange 2010 that needed a quick, I think it was, there was a security patch issued and then an update roll up soon afterwards. Those won't be coming anymore. So,
right.
It's rare, but it certainly could happen. It certainly could happen. I was looking through my books earlier and I'm thinking, do I throw these out? And I don't think, I'm looking at this here. It's the Exchange Server 2010 Inside Out book.
Inside when, Out. There's a name when for the only, best.
Yeah, when only one Exchange Inside Out book was needed. There was the second, the last one that was made? You wrote one volume and Tony wrote the other.
Right. Starting with Exchange 2013, Tony found that not even he could produce a single volume that covered everything in Exchange 2013. So I wrote the chapters or the content on unified messaging, which I still miss, and the CAS and some other things. And that was in a second volume, whereas he did the mailbox and compliance stuff in the main volume.
And although this book was written by Tony, I noticed you did the technical review.
I did.
So you kept Tony honest when he was writing about it Inside Out. Because Exchange 2010 has had it's had more of a place in one's heart than most of us. Because were you at one point doing some of the MCM training as well?
I was. I was one of the instructors for MCM, starting with MCM 2007. And for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, back in ancient days, Microsoft used to have a program called Microsoft Certified Master, which was a capstone certification that you could aspire to once you had completed a certain level of MCSC certification and had a certain level of professional experience. So originally when MCM started, it was only offered to Microsoft employees. Then they broadened it to include invited guests from their biggest partners, so including HP and at the time Compaq. It was a 6-week course and it cost $25,000, which seems insane to think about that now. No. I mean, that's a year's college tuition in many places in the US. But the technical training was in such depth that companies were willing to pay for it. And so the program continued on. Microsoft retooled it several times, and eventually they killed it at a time when the cloud was becoming ascendant. I think it's safe to say they looked at the cost to put on the MCM program and the benefit that they thought accrued to Microsoft from having really deeply well-trained, technically knowledgeable architects, and said, well, in the future, there won't be any Exchange architects because you will plug your Exchange into the wall and get it from the cloud. And turns out they were right. But yes, at that time, I was still one of the MCM 2010 rotation instructors.
And that's a weighty book. And it's weird. A lot of the stuff inside these books today, obviously there's been improvements in 2013, 2016, 2019 since. But a lot of it is still pretty applicable. All that conceptual things, they've changed very little over that time. So it's kind of testament to that. The other thing that is probably more impactful for some organizations that really have not got with the curve is some of those other products, especially the Office suite as well. Office 2010 used to be, it used to be the client for Office 365.
Right.
And until there was a big push to move to Windows 10, over the last couple of years, a lot of customers, even though Microsoft had de-emphasized, then started to remove support or official support for using Office 2010 with Office 365. People were still using it, and it still continues to work to this day. So I think there's also a good task for people, if they haven't, to make sure that you look in the reporting in the portal and check that you haven't got some stragglers out there.
Good point.
I mean, you know, if you are keeping modern, then you'll have, by now, hopefully, moved to modern authentication for Exchange. And one of the prerequisites for doing that is getting rid of older versions of Outlook and Office. But, you know, there's going to be people out there that are using it. So it is crucial, you know, as the product is out of support, as well as out of support with Office 365, to make sure that you don't have any clients out there at all. It's time to bin it.
It's hard to let go, but it's necessary. It's part of the circle of life.
I've met someone recently within the last year who's effectively said, you know, you can pull Office 2010 out of my cold, dead hands, pretty much. They're very attached to it. And if you're running that on a modern PC, you know, it can feel very snappy. And, you know, it's a reliable client, but it's just not built for the modern world of Office 365. And it's just time to let go. It's going to be all right. Just relax. It'll be fine.
Take a deep breath.
I won't say his name.
As Marie Kondo would say, bless and release. It's okay to let those old Office 2010 CDs with the product key stickers, it's okay to let those go.
I tell you what, in my lab, I rebuilt my lab server. I've not got rid of any of those things. I've still got them in case I need them. In fact, I've even got Exchange 5.5 ISOs. I just can't bring
myself.
I'm
having visions of your daughters, you know, 50 years from now, having to go through this giant trunk of stuff in your attic and finding those CDs and having no idea what they are.
It's behind me in these drawers. It's all there. Everything. I've even got my Solaris 9 certification.
Oh, good God.
I know.
Is there no limit to the depths that you will sink to?
Come on, you've got a drawer. You've got a drawer that's just full of cables, right?
No, sir.
No?
No, when I moved in with Erica earlier this year, so you can't see the video if you're listening along at home, but I've got a detached 12-foot by 16-foot outbuilding where I keep my office and also where the cat lives. And in the process of moving here, I had to be absolutely ruthless about just getting rid of stuff. And so I did. I took it probably wasn't a cubic meter, but it couldn't have been far off, a giant box of cables and chargers and adapters. I had old, you know, Macintosh, Apple Talk adapters. I had all kinds of stuff that I had saved, as one does, because, you know, I might need this someday. And finally, the day had come for me to recognize and let go of all those ancient adapters going back to, you know, probably 1995, if not earlier. I had ancient stuff that I hadn't used in a decade or more, and it was time.
The best metaphor I found when explaining that sort of chuck out the stuff you don't use is when people are talking about moving to the cloud. And with Exchange, not many people take that approach. You know, we don't go and clean out users' mailboxes and tell them to only bring what they want. But certainly on the OneDrive and SharePoint migrations, that sort of approach is often key, where there's that balance. You know, when I move house, we're getting a skip. But I'm not going to throw out the cables. I used one of them today. I bought something off Amazon. I got one of those Fire TV cubes. I had the right cable in the drawer. It was worth keeping. But my wife will chuck them all out. We digress a little bit. I'm not sure how we got here. But there's a bunch of new stuff this week as well. And we're not going to go through everything one by one, because you know, we could spend, as we did on season one of the podcast, we could spend 40 minutes just reeling through every single new change in Office 365 each week. So we're just going to talk about some of the more interesting things that have actually arrived inside Tenants.
Right.
So what was the one thing you picked out then this week?
So I actually picked two because I'm greedy like that. It's also the reason that my cookies are never safe around me. But the first one is small and the second one is larger. So the first one is we're finally getting the ability to turn a Teams message directly into a task from the desktop client.
Okay.
That's rolling out in November. It just went on the roadmap within the last couple of days. And so the idea is that you will be able to click a particular message and instantly turn it into a task. The reason I'm excited about that is I've been trying for more than a month to get that functionality to work with Power Automate. There's a Power Automate trigger called for selected message that you're supposed to be able to use on Teams messages. And the damn thing just doesn't work. I have four tenants and I cannot get that action to appear in any of them. I have Microsoft support engaged. I know other people who have it working, so I don't know if this is just a bias against me personally on the part of the Teams team or if it's bad karma or what. But very common use case, if I'm in Teams having a conversation with somebody and they say, can you please do X?
Well, yeah.
Naturally, the correct outcome of that is not for me to just try to remember it. It's to turn it into a task somewhere. So having that integrated into the client is going to be a big win.
Yeah, I had seen people tweet about that today, but I hadn't noticed it on the roadmap. That'll be good if it allows you to choose. So, whether, you know, because tasks in Teams is not only planner, but it's also to do as well. So that will be pretty useful, actually. I've never really tried to do it, but it wouldn't be something that I'd automate and then try and encourage everybody else to do the same thing. But that's pretty nifty, because I know when I've been working on projects, I found it quite difficult where people ask you to do things to try and keep track of those. So that is something that's small, but I see what you mean. That could make a big difference.
I think that it will. And coupled with that, the bigger thing that I'm excited about is the GA appearance of the tasks module in Teams.
Yeah.
Microsoft has been talking about this for a while. They actually introduced or publicly announced it at the National Federation of Retail show January, February. It was earlier this year. It was so long ago in COVID years that I don't remember exactly what it was. But we've been waiting for that functionality to appear. And so this is sort of continuing the Outlookification of the Teams client, where it continues to gain new modules that are just access points to data that isn't owned by the Teams platform. So when you use
I think Teams has always been that way, though.
Oh, it has been. Yeah, but they're just this is just another example of them further, if I may use the phrase, embrace and extend.
I mean, to me, Teams is it's almost a window to your applications in Office 365. I like the terminology. Instead of having an app name, it talks about the thing that you're going to do. Because I don't know about you, I found with the adoption side, explaining product names to people is no good. They don't care about product names. You know, Office 365 is one product name enough. Teams is too many. But you know, explaining what something is and then what it does when there's so many, it just becomes tough. But with like the communities app, with the calendar app, with the chat app, it makes sense. It's better than calling it the Skype app and the Outlook app or the Exchange app.
That's a good point.
So I think TAS makes a lot of sense, and it means that you don't have to explain the difference between To Do and Planner.
Well,
you've just got different types of tasks.
You would think that, but of course, in very typical Microsoft fashion, the nomenclature is a little confusing because of the fact that in the tasks module within Teams, you will see things labeled as being from Planner or from To Do.
Well, there was they put some of this to MVPs to give an opinion on, and I know I voted that way because it's still got to relate back to where it is. But I think not having to explain where you go for, you know, having to look in different places for tasks, you just look in tasks, makes some sense. It's never going to be perfect, though, is it?
Well, at least what I found confuses
things a bit more.
I love the idea of having the tasks in the Teams application because I can context switch to them. But at least for ordinary tasks, the functionality in the To Do application is better.
Yeah.
It's easier to work with tasks. You get the pleasant little ding sound when you click something off. There are better sorting and filtering options and so on. So in fairness, it's early days for this module, but I have high hopes that Microsoft is going to continue to let me, you know, tasks are interesting to me because they're sort of a seasoning for other data types. Yeah. When you're working in a Word document or you're having a conversation in a Teams channel, there are all these different places where you might want to just sort of take your salt shaker and sprinkle a little task on top to give somebody else a task to do or to track a task that you need to do. You certainly can work with tasks as a first-class workload. But to me, the real value comes when I can very quickly, in the middle of doing something else, either assign a task, create a task, or complete a task that's pertinent to the thing that I'm working on. I see them continuing to do more of that kind of integration, which is really one of the areas where Teams shines.
And we've got some more features this week as well. So the first one I wanted to mention was Microsoft are giving things away for free. It's not the first time, though, that they've done that. So this year, Microsoft, earlier in the year, they did that COVID special, 6 months free on Teams. Get them early, get them hooked on Teams. And, you know, that, Zoom obviously have done the same thing as well, and probably Slack, but, you know, who uses that? And then a little bit later at Microsoft Inspire, their big partner conference, they made an announcement and then sort of rolled it back, and they were going to give free voice minutes as part of E5. And then that's quite quietly disappeared. And they didn't explain, you know, much as to why, which is within their rights, I guess. But this one's interesting because maybe they've, you know, given some things away for free like that, then rolled them back, and now they've brought this new offer to give everybody audio conferencing for free for a whole year. And there's not a massive downside to that, really, is there? Unless, of course, you just bought it for everybody.
And, you know, that's always the risk. Whenever Microsoft gives something away for free, there's always some percentage of their customer base that just paid for it and is now unhappy. I guess, you know, to me, I wonder where the data points. Does Microsoft, or let me rephrase that. Where does Microsoft expect to capitalize on this as a business opportunity? So it could be that their motivation is truly, we're going to spend some of our own money to help our customers by giving them this thing for free that we formerly would have charged for. And I'm certainly not saying that's not their motive. But if you ask how does Microsoft benefit by doing this? I think the question is really interesting because I would wonder, how much dial-in audio conferencing is actually used today compared to 6 months ago? If you're in a conference room and you have to join someone else's meeting, the natural modality we're all used to is you drag the, you know, Polycom UFO phone to the middle of the table and somebody dials in, right? Everybody knows how to do that. If you're in the car and you need to join a conference, you dial it on your phone. Those are very familiar, but they sort of have an odor of 2010. About them. When you think of it in a world where now everybody has ubiquitous high quality mobile devices, almost everybody has ubiquitous high quality bandwidth everywhere they go. And people have standardized on Teams as their business conferencing solution. You know, with that said, I had a user contact me in quite a hurry yesterday because he did not have an audio conferencing license and he urgently had to get audio conferencing working for a meeting he had today and needed the license provision and his conferencing set up right away because of this meeting. So it certainly does happen, but I guess I have to guess that this seems like a way for Microsoft to give away something that they might not be able to sell anyway and that seems more valuable than maybe it actually is in use. I don't know. I could be off base there.
I tend to agree because if you look at it at a high level, you think, well, this might make it more accessible for people who haven't got internet connectivity or have got limited bandwidth. But in a lot of those scenarios, you know, if somebody's given a dial-in number, and this might be different in the US, but at least here, it'd cost some money to dial a local rate number. I don't get entirely free calls at home on the landline, the old PSTN number.
You have a landline?
I don't even know the number. to be fair, and
if you're keeping your Solaris 9 certifications, why does it surprise me that you also have a landline?
I didn't want one. You have to have one. But when I move house, there's a fiber cable. That's all that comes in.
Right.
But they insist on giving you a phone. So you have a phone, and it's a SIP phone. It's like, I don't need one. I don't need a number. I've got a mobile. So I don't ever use it, apart from when my dad phones, who seems to think it will be cheaper to phone me on my landline. So, but apart from, you know, there's that, right? If you had no phone at all, no cell, but everybody has a cell, right? Don't they? You know, I'm sure more people have a cell phone around the world than they do landlines.
That's no question.
Third world, people who don't have a landline at home in the UK, most of them will have mobiles. And if you have mobiles, then you probably have data. So I'm not going from the data. I don't know this, you know, for sure. So I think it's not necessarily a bad thing. But I'd be keener to drive people towards using a data dial-in. That's what I use if I'm
right
on a call in the car. I find that more than passable. You know, I get much better quality audio than I would if I was dialed into the meeting. And the Teams client, you know, works with hands-free systems, Bluetooth systems. It works in all those kind of scenarios. So I'd have thought, it's useful, but perhaps it's one of those areas where they want to maybe see whether it sticks, if customers use it, and might drive them towards keeping that as an add-on or moving to E5.
That's the only thing that I can, the only reason I can think of for them to do this is because they believe it will drive more revenue to them than if they don't do it, if they keep charging for it. But I'm reminded of the sketch from South Park with the gnomes who want to steal underpants. And, you know, the step three is profit, and step two is a bunch of question marks. Mm-hmm. I don't know what lies in between giving people audio conferencing for free and making more money from the overall service portfolio. There's got to be something in there. Microsoft, you know, they're commercially very sharp, or very astute. And so there must be some underlying reason why this is a good thing for Microsoft. I just don't know what it is.
I think as it is something that customers still regularly add on, then it's got to be worth taking them up on that offer and seeing whether it has a use. And another good reason could be if you've not managed to roll out clients to phones, you've not managed to do all those things yet, or you're having a bit of trouble with that adoption, because it's easy for me to say how well it works for me, but I know I'm not someone in the business who's not very tech savvy, and does know how to dial a number on a phone, but doesn't know how to install and sign into the Teams app on my phone. It might give you that peace between getting people adopted with all the right applications and using Teams the right way from now, so you can still get them into the meetings, into the calls, and get over that bridge where maybe they're struggling today and would actually be a bit more comfortable dialing into the meetings with their home phone rather than a badly positioned webcam on their laptop and so on, or trying to struggle to balance very little bandwidth when they're teaching the kids at home, and also trying to do their job. So maybe it will help bridge that gap, and then maybe some customers will keep it, and some customers it'll just be something that they've used as a bridge solution. No pun intended.
You know, anytime Microsoft gives you something for free, it's a good thing. You know, yes. I certainly encourage customers to take advantage of this, because even if you only use audio conferencing for, say, 5% of your conferences, you're getting that 5% for free and not having to buy the license for the next year. So why not take advantage of it? Worst case, you
and there don't are things. It. There are things that they gave for free and then said that they were going to charge for, priority notifications, which, to be fair, I wasn't sure why those would cost money. Maybe, you know, extra few CPU cycles to run them. And they said that was going to be free until a certain point, and then it would be chargeable, or you need a certain license. And of course, when it came to it at the end, they said, no, well, you can just have them for free. So it could be that this has suddenly become significantly cheaper for Microsoft to deliver. And perhaps they will keep it as part of all the products. It could be that there's other market offerings that, you know, we're not as deep into that are providing this as part of their service as well. And it helps them compete better, as you know. So perhaps there's other reasons like that. I mean, talking of mobiles and Teams meetings, the other one that I have had arrive for me this week and is showing in the Message Center as something that is finally here for all tenants is transferring meetings between different devices. So are you familiar with companion mode?
Maybe.
Maybe.
tell me what it is, and I'll tell you if I know what it is or not.
Okay, so companion mode, we've written about in Practical 365 before. But when you're in a Teams meeting on the desktop, you join from a mobile, right? And you could join the meeting, or you can join the meeting twice, which is pretty cool. So imagine me and you're in a meeting here, and I wanted to show you a piece of equipment. Maybe I wanted to show you this book. Instead of holding it up to the camera, I could join a second time, and then I could flip the camera on my mobile, and we'd still be able to talk face to face, but we'd see a third video feed as me in the meeting again, you know, not as another participant, where I can show you the camera or the feed from the book, which is great if you were trying to demo something. Right. I've had customers
that they said, I use that feature, but hand to God, I had no idea it was called companion mode.
Well, there you go. And you can also use it to share content into meetings.
See, people, you
as well.
Do learn things from this podcast. This is great.
Now, you could covertly join the meeting, keep it on mute, then mute yourself on your desktop, unmute yourself on the phone, and sort of try that sort of juggle of two devices and hope nobody really noticed as you moved. So perhaps you wanted to pop and grab yourself a coffee or like me, you know, I need to go on the school run and I'm really there to listen in that meeting anyway. So I find it really useful to be able to use the new transfer feature, and I was really pleased when it arrived, because it does mean that if I need to go, or I've started the meeting while I'm on the move or in the kitchen, then when I get into my office and I've got all of the lights, camera and stuff like that, I can then press the join button on the desktop, and then it gives me the option on my screen to transfer the call across, and then it or continue it on both. And I press the transfer button and it natively switches me. So I might have my mobile like that. I'm chatting away to a colleague. I press transfer and I just move the phone out of the way. And I literally the other day got back after the school run, had my phone in front of me in my hand. I was chatting to a couple of colleagues. I popped the phone down there, carried on chatting, put on my headset, pressed transfer across. And we just carried on, like, you know, it didn't interrupt the flow of the meeting. And it's, you know, it wasn't one of those weird, oh, how did you do that kind of moments either. It's just, it worked naturally and it didn't seem strange. And with the kids back at school in the UK for me and popping out for the school runs on the days I do them, that's been quite useful because, you know, I don't want to disrupt my day and because I've got to do stuff like that. So I find it really good. So that's sort of been a big bonus to me, where I've been, you know, I've been trying to juggle that companion mode,
right?
Or say I'm just heading out. I'll dial back in a minute once I've got set up downstairs, and I found that's really useful. So
I will tell you this right now. I have a charging pedestal. Well, the cable is not long enough for me to put it on camera, but I have a charging pedestal that my headset rests in. I would pay cash money, Jabra and Plantronics and Poly. I hope you guys are listening. I would pay cash money for a physical accessory that was smart enough to automatically transfer calls under some kind of physical action. So if I'm on a call on my mobile and I sit down at my desk and I pick up my headset, transfer the call to it. If I have a little puck with an NFC tag and I tap my phone on it, transfer the call to my phone. That way, as I'm on my way out of my office, I can say, oh, hold on just one second, tap, take my headset off, put the phone up to my ear at the same time, and walk out without missing a beat. And it certainly would not be hard to implement. So free idea for all the ODMs out there. Y'all get busy on that.
This is the closest you'll get to that at the moment, though. And this is the closest we've ever came to that working, because it never worked in Skype for Business like that.
No.
And the Poly software did have the ability to connect to your phone as well, so it'd update your presence, but it wouldn't let you do that transfer. So it knew when you were on a call on your phone, but it didn't do that interface. But it had set your Skype presence to busy. You know, if someone phones you on your mobile, and I at the time I thought the same thing. I thought that they know that I'm on a call. Well, perhaps they could have some software on it that did this. Perhaps they could integrate it with Skype, but no. And this is the closest to that sort of Nirvana I've ever had. So it might sound like a small little thing, like one button, compared to, you know, what wasn't bad in Teams, but was just a bit fiddly. But I really like it. I really do. That's made up for the disappointment of knowing that Exchange 2010 has went out of support this week.
Well, we have to take comfort wherever we can find it in these trying times.
In fact, both of the best books about Exchange 2010 have a practical 365 connection. So you were the technical reviewer for Inside Out. Do you remember, or if you're listening at home, do you remember the Exchange Server 2010?
Yes, the best practices guides that Microsoft Press used to do. Boy, I miss those.
Yes, foreword by David Espinosa. Wow. And a foreword by Tony Redmond as well. And that was written by the lead author for that was Siggy. So, you know, 2010, you know, and of course Exchange Server Pro had all the best guides on 2010 as well. You know, 2003 to 2010 upgrade guides. And excellent stuff that a lot of colleagues of mine, you know, used as well. So we can only try and look towards the future and try and make some really good guides on going ahead.
You're really making me nostalgic, Steve. I feel like I need to
go out nostalgic and today.
Like watch some sci-fi movies from the 1950s, or you know.
It's not that old. I loved Exchange Server 2010. That really was my favorite version of Exchange, and I think so many people agree with that. 2013, you know, had its problems when it came in, but it feels like 2013, 2016, 2019. They're like the Windows 10. They're great. They're lovely. They all sort of feel like one long version that's slowly changed, and 2010. Will always be a top version for me, you know. We've went on for far longer than we should have today.
We probably have at this point. Our listeners are entitled to their adult beverage of choice, you know, kind of to join us in commemorating the passing of our old friend.
Yes, I'm going to raise a glass to Exchange 2010,
as we all should,
and then probably. Finish configuring a 2010 DAG for a guide I'm going to write on Practical 365 to try and help some of you that haven't fully decommissioned yours yet. If you've listened this far and you're not feeling so nostalgic because it's still a pain in the proverbial for you today, then give us a tweet or comment on the blog post today. Let us know the things that are keeping you on 2002.
I would love to see that list.
Well, then we can, you know, there's a good chance that either other people in the community or, you know, myself and other MVPs, we've seen these kind of challenges before. We can provide some ideas back. Plus, it might give us some great ideas for articles so we can squeeze the last bit of juice out of 2010. We will be back, of course, in a couple of weeks' time. So don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, either on your favourite podcast app or over on practical365.com. Thanks for listening and tune in next time.
Thank you all very much. See you next time, Steve.